The views and opinions expressed in the Humanizing the Headset podcast are those of the authors, guests, and hosts of the podcast, and do not necessarily reflect the opinion or position of Humanizing the Headset as a whole. This podcast may contain adult language and adult content.
Welcome back, everybody.
Yes, podcast number four.
I think so.
Lucky number four.
We have a really awesome surprise guest with us today. Woo-hoo. We have Adam Tim. Adam, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you do?
I'm Adam Tim, and I'm here. Happy to be here. do you want to know?
Well, for those of us that aren't familiar, because I know you've reached a lot of people out there and a lot of people are familiar. People seem to always be excited about passing your information on, but I'm sure there's some person in the corner of the United States or even the world that don't know what it is that you do.
I'm certain there's people who have not in 911 specifically who don't know who I am or what I do. But super brief synopsis. I was a dispatcher for a little over 10 years at the Los Angeles Police Department, call taking, dispatching, and experienced the challenges of the job. I grappled with cumulative stress and burnout for the first 7 years of my career, and I was not a very nice person. And I got a discipline record that pushed me to change things if I wanted to keep my job, basically. And it wasn't until things got really bad, like I had an ulcer and a bad attitude and vented my rage and frustration on callers and coworkers and supervisors, that I took a class, a stress reduction class. And at the 7-year mark, things changed dramatically for the better. And I left LAPD. It's been over 7 years now. I left LAPD to do training and consulting full time on my own for the 911 industry. And that company is called The Healthy Dispatcher. So I founded The Healthy Dispatcher to do training and consulting, and just crisscrossed the country for the last 6-7 years doing that. And I'd recently joined the team at Rapid Deploy. Rapid Deploy provides software solutions for 911. We have a CAD product, we have a data analytics product, and we have a mapping and location accuracy product. And so I have kind of made it my life's work to try to provide inspiration and improvements to this industry that is so challenging, both from a frontline telecommunicator perspective, as well as from a management perspective. Like, there's so many challenges that the 911 industry faces, and I've just been trying to add value and try to improve things over the last, it's been 17 years since I started at LAPD as a 911 dispatcher.
Yeah, that's awesome. We're super excited to have you here today. I've taken one of Adam's classes, and when I tell you it was life-changing, I'm not being like goofy or silly. Like, it genuinely changed my perspective on a lot of things. Absolutely. So that's why we wanted to bring Adam on today, because he really has awesome perspective on this. So,
well, I think it's interesting. So when Brendan started Humanizing the Headset, obviously, the whole idea is make us healthy in various ways. And I think the biggest thing as dispatchers, two things: culture, right? The negative culture that gets bred in a 911 center. And I swear, I don't know how it's possible, but it's that way all over the place. Like, that's the one similarity. You could have a center in LA and a center in like Timbuktu someplace, and they would all have the same attitudes and the same issues with one another.
Yeah.
So I can't figure out if it's inherent to the job or if it's just inherent to people. And then of course our
a little bit of both.
Our healthy eating habits, you know, sitting at the desk.
Our
stress relief, I think, half the time, jamming gummy bears in your face. And of course the public wants to bring you all kinds of treats because they think that's what you need, right?
Right.
Here's my comfort cake. Tacos.
We already have a very sedentary job, so then stuffing snacks in our face all day isn't helping.
But... And then add the stressful phone calls and the spiteful coworkers that just skyrocket your cortisol and all that good stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
Well, so we got a bunch of questions both from our team, from our HTH team, and we solicited questions from our Facebook group and our Instagram page, specifically about morale, because obviously morale has been a huge point this year, especially with everything going on. I think morale is extremely low among first responders in general, among everyone in general. But a lot of people have been reaching out to us lately asking for help on how to deal with specific situations at work. So we wanted to try to bring on an expert like Adam, who might be able to give us some good advice about that.
Yes, sir.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. We're expecting you to fix all the world's problems
in an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And go.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the list of questions looks really, really interesting. And I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation, which is a conversation that's near and dear to my heart. You asked about why most communication centers seem to resemble each other with regard to the challenges and the problems that we face. And I've seen that. I've seen that the problems that each communication center in the country faces are universal. The problems are universal, but I've also seen that the solutions are universal. And I've written a couple of books on the topic. I wrote a dispatcher stress book, 50 Lessons on Beating the Burnout, which kind of gave me an opportunity to put in pages all of the tools that changed my life at the 7-year mark as a frontline dispatcher. And as I was crisscrossing the country doing training classes, I found that there were these amazing stories of centers that were different places to work. I would be amazed. So I would do a class on the East Coast, and there'd be 100 dispatchers in the class, and I'd hear little pockets of conversation in the group activities where people would say interesting things like, I love my job. I love the team that I work for. And my ears would always perk up because as you've already spoken to, that's a rare thing to hear in our industry. It is rare to hear that people actually like their coworkers, that they like the job that they do on a daily basis, and that the first thing out of their mouth isn't, oh my gosh, I got to work another shift tomorrow. And if I have to do that, I can't wait to retirement. And you ask them how long they've got until retirement. They're like, well, I think it's 16 years, 3 hours and 2 minutes.
Right.
So, yep. I mean, that's a long slog. So,
right, yeah.
So I started to ask follow-up questions of these folks who would say these audacious things. And I learned that there are centers, and this is something that we can all do on an individual level. It doesn't take the city manager or the chief of police or even the executive director of your communications center to make positive change possible. At an individual level, someone decided at these exemplary centers that the status quo doesn't work. It just doesn't work anymore. So what do we do with that information? What do we do with that knowledge? And then they got busy. They got busy changing these things. And I put a whole bunch of these conversations and case study interviews in my most recent book, which is People Driven Leadership, How the Best 911 Centers Inspire Positive Change. And that book is really just an articulation of the stories of the dozens of supervisors, managers, and directors, and the employees that work at these centers who have dared to dream different. They've dared to write a new story. So I'm not I'm not going to be sharing anything that I've personally done aside from the kind of personal epiphany of, geez, you know, I'm not a very nice person. And geez, you know, this ulcer might have this ulcer might have something to do with the way I think about my life and the way and the people around me. Aside from my personal transformation, I've been fortunate to kind of glean these nuggets of inspiration from people in the industry across the country. So the industry is rife with negativity. That's the nature of our business, but it's not required that every communication center is a negative place to work. Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even that possibility is foreign to some, depending on, I know folks who have worked at the same communication center for 15 years, and it's always been this way. The way we've always done it, I'm doing little air quotes here, is we treat each other like shit, and that's just the way it is.
That's so awful. Like, why do we do that to each other?
We don't know any better.
Right.
That's terrible.
In the way that we're modeling, so you think of it from a leadership perspective. If your supervisors, if their supervisors, and above them have practiced this way of just being however we are, without giving it any thought, that's the lens with which you see the world. So it takes a certain degree of self-awareness to see what is actually going on. So once that happens, once we take a step back and kind of survey the way things are, only then is there an opportunity. So I think that's the first step, and that's the first step for any listeners out there. If you notice that there is an area of your life, both in and out of the communication center, that is ripe for change. And you might say, well, how do I know that? Well, you know, we're masters of self-deception, but ultimately we know when there are signs, clear signs and symptoms of a need for change in our life. We just, we conveniently overlook those things, those clear signs. I did for years. I was getting sustained citizen complaints on while working the non-emergency line at the LAPD center, and I didn't take responsibility for what I said on a recorded line. Like I'm taking my aggression out on a caller. Like it's live, record. there's evidence. It's right there. And I say, well, those callers. They just try your last nerve. And what I noticed in the body language and the facial expression of the supervisor who is in charge of kind of doling out my punishment is, I could see them being deflated when they realize that they're dealing with one of those employees who's never going to take responsibility for their actions. And it's just a waste of time to try to pave inroads into this worn negativity. Like that's, if you're so far beyond help, meaning you have no idea that you actually need help, then you're going to repel any opportunities for assistance. And I think that we can look at that at both an individual level as well as an organizational level.
Mm. Okay. It's on topic, so it might not be a question in this list or it may get answered in there, but if you have a person like that, so from a supervisor standpoint, you can see it in people. And I'm not a fan, so just to go back a little bit, you said something that strikes a chord with me. Just because we've always done it this way doesn't mean it has to be done that way. I absolutely hate that mentality. And depending on who's projecting that mentality, it's difficult to get past, you know, if you're talking about administration or leadership and they're set in their ways, it's hard to affect change.
Right.
So I know that's a challenge, and I can actually see it on my screen here. That's one of the questions about administration, and obviously we'll get to that. But if you have a person that you could clearly see is having those types of struggles, or multiple people, how do you get them to see it? Can you get them to see it?
And how do you do it in like a tactful way that's constructive and not
right
and not
not, hey, you're being an asshole. Yeah, right. You know, you need to stop. Right.
I mean, I would say that there may be a time and a place for even that to be said in a tactful way, or those specific words. I mean, we first of all, we have to be able to build rapport with our people. So if you're in a supervisory role, and so you're a working supervisor, and not only do you have the job of the console at on top of you, but you also are sandwiched in between the frontline telecommunicators and the upper management, who at many centers feels like they don't care. So now I have to deal with this. First of all, I have a tremendous amount of empathy for those who feel the plight of the middle manager. So the challenge with being kind of sandwiched in that tough spot is it is your responsibility to say something when no one else will. And you say, well, why is that my responsibility? Well, because you have the awareness. It's kind of like, have you ever been in a relationship that was ripe for a breakup? And you're the only party to this awareness. Like, you know that you have to get out of this relationship.
Right.
And,
oh, yeah.
And you're like, you know, I this would be so much easier if my partner just broke up with me, because then I could say, you know, I've been thinking a lot about it as well, and you're right, we should just go our separate ways. But you've been thinking that way for 3 years and they still aren't on board. And so you eventually had to initiate that conversation, and it sucked, and it was heartbreaking, and there were tears, and it was every bit as bad as you dreaded. But at the end, you ripped the band-aid off, and 2 weeks later, after the dust had settled, you felt much, much better. It's similar to having a tough conversation with a disgruntled employee when no one else will. I marvel at how many comm centers are in that place. Like, there's one person out of a team of 30 who ruins the watch, who ruins the reputation for the entire communication center. And it's been like that for 10 years and no one has actually had a conversation with them.
Huh.
Yeah, I my manager has always said, like, I can't address a problem if you guys don't make me aware of it.
Right.
And that always strikes really true with me, because it's like, yeah, people will complain and bitch about their partners or their partners doing something, but
yeah.
You ever actually talked to anyone about it other than just bitching to someone else about it?
Right. And Norm and I were talking yesterday about perception, you know, because you get so used to this negative attitude,
right,
that they say something or do something and you automatically interpret it as them being a bitch.
Oh, yeah,
you know, and they're not. It's just the way you interpret it, because that's your attitude towards it.
Right. Mm. Yeah. And I think so to your question, I know we started kind of big picture. And so drilling down, you have to, first of all, you have to decide as a team. And this is work that I find most communication centers haven't done a lot of, and would do well to do some of it. You have to decide as a team what you stand for. And examples of this include your center values, your core values. Examples include your mission statement, your purpose statement, your vision statement. And I strongly encourage every communication center to do this work independent of the agency that you support. I run into some communication center that say, yeah, we have the police department, so they're police primary answering point. And they say, yeah, the police department at large has their vision and mission statement, but it doesn't really mean anything to communication center personnel. That's not enough. There's a disconnect there. So you get to decide as a team what you stand for. And if one of your core values is respect for each other, and on a daily basis, there's blatant disrespect, and it's not it's objective. Like, objectively, we can say that this is disrespectful behavior and no one is saying anything, then we don't know what we stand for. In fact, we're modeling
responsible.
Yeah, we're modeling a way that it's okay to do whatever.
Right.
You know, and so you say, okay, great. We've done this work. now I have to have this conversation. So you start coaching this person around what's going on with them. There's a director at a PSAP in Missouri, and when she took over the role, there was one of these problem children, and she was dreading having that conversation with this problem child because she feared that because the previous administration had documented all the transgression of this problem child, she was afraid that this would be the end game, that this conversation that she was about to go into was going to be the end. The formal discipline dismissal proceedings. And the director started the conversation with the problem child. Hey, you know, I'm coming into this role, and I'm looking at the circumstances and situation, and I see that we have a problem here, and I'm curious what I can do to help you. And that olive branch started a conversation that resulted in the problem child, the quote unquote problem child, deciding on three specific action steps that she could take on to improve her impact on the floor, on morale, on her work product. And all it took was the director saying, hey, we have a problem. And I'm basically indicating to you, and she didn't say this, but what she was showing in her tone, in her words, in her body language, I am on your side. And a year later, a year after that conversation, that problem child was nominated and selected as Employee of the Year by her peers.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
And it was because someone took initiative to say, hey, I recognize what's going on. I see you. And do you see it the way I see it? And yeah, you have to be tactful. Yeah, you have to, aside from being tactful in that conversation, we have to be willing to have that conversation. And I mean, again, I have a tremendous amount of empathy for any frontline supervisor who has to have, whose job is to have those conversations, because you have no idea what you're walking into. It could have been very different. The other person could have been. The other person could say, oh, my God, hey, you're one to talk. You're the new director. You come in here and you're waving your banner of we're going to be better. You just step off, get out of my face. But I find that if you have the courage to have those conversations, they almost always turn out better than you expect, because we're catastrophizers. Think about what we do for a living.
Right.
The worst case scenario.
Yeah. And it's interesting because that person put the ownership back on the person who was having the issues with the attitude involving them, showing them that they're going to support them, but it put it back on them to figure out what the problems were and correct it and really look at why am I having this problem,
but making the person accountable for their
awesome. And the reality is if I tell you, you know, this is my problem. So Kaylee comes to me and says, you know, Norm, I noticed this. How can you fix it? How can we fix it? Whatever. And I create the list. Well, if I'm not doing it, that ownership completely is my issue.
Right.
You know, you came up with the list. You know, it's not like I created a list and, you know, the whole lead a horse to water thing. Mm-hmm. No offense to anybody that, you know, looks like a horse or anything as far as dispatchers. Exactly. Whoa, fella. I like that, actually. That's very cool, because
I think the biggest challenge in those conversations is depersonalizing what's going on. So can you speak to issues? Can you speak to the objective reality, the facts of the matter? And it's not about the person. It's, and that's, again, that's why it really helps to have done the upfront work of mission, purpose, values, because when you get everybody together and say to collectively, this is what we stand for. And then you say, agree, you agree, right? We all agree that this is the type of center that we want to be a part of working for and towards. And it, that's like, you get people to say, yes, yes. You don't move off that question until you get everybody bought in. That's a powerful place to be, because you have united a team, which previous in a lot of cases seemed like ununitable, especially across 24-hour watches and with everything that we're doing, the pandemic and everything, short staffing, all the problems that we're familiar with. But then you get to say, this documented behavior, that quality assurance, that recording, when you said this and the caller flipped out and then you retaliated, what was going on there? You allow people, I think we, in a lot of ways, skim over the fact that we're all adults, that we all have chosen to be where we are, especially when it comes to work. We have all signed on the dotted line, and every 2 weeks or however long, how often you get paid, you agree to be a part of this mission, whatever that looks like. And I think a lot of people, they don't really feel like they've consciously chosen their station in life. They're just like, you know, and I speak from my own experience up until the age 30. I just thought I was a Delta bum hand and shit, I'll just deal with it. And it wasn't until I kind of moved into a more intentional place in my life, in my own consciousness, that I was like, oh yeah, you know, I do have a choice. Like, we all have a choice.
We do. And I think what people don't think about is choices are an awesome thing.
Right.
You know, they're so important, and it's amazing to be able to have them. So ultimately, like you said, if you've signed on the dotted line that this is what I wanted to do, that was your choice. And now if you're not happy here, you have the choice of moving on or correcting what the issue is. You have two choices. Yeah. Make your life better at work. Right. Actually, three. You have three choices. Continue to be miserable and terrible to everybody around you, which isn't really an option, but you can make that choice, and then other choices are going to be made for you.
Right.
Or you can choose to make it better and correct it. Or you could choose to move on and do something else that might make you happy. And in some cases, I think that might be the case. The stress, depending on where you work and the amount of call volume and the types of calls you take, that might be an option for people, because people can only take so much. And I mean, we're surprisingly resilient, but I mean, come on, not everybody's meant to do this for 30 years.
No, I think, like, especially, you know, you hear your partners, and we all have days where, like, every time the phone rings, you just want to put your head through a wall. But then when you stop and think about it, you're like, why am I upset about it? This is my literal job, is to answer the, like, why am I getting upset that the phone's ringing? That's why I'm here.
Right.
Yeah. There's no reason to be angry about that or throwing a fit every time the phone rings. That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So do what you can to make that phone call a pleasant one.
Right. Right.
And, you know, one of the things you said a little bit ago, Adam, and it made me think of this, because I think, you know, Brendan and I talked, like said, or he said, for a while yesterday about some of this type of stuff, is people think that confrontation has to be a fight or an argument. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. You have to confront an issue, but it doesn't have to be negative confrontation.
Right.
You know, and I guess maybe it's in the word confrontation, but you know, I don't know my Latin derivatives and stuff, but it doesn't have to be negative. I can come to you and say, hey, I have this issue with you, or there is an issue that needs to be addressed. And it doesn't have to be, we build it up to be more than it actually is the majority of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. We steel ourselves for the fight ahead. I think the those who are masters at having these conversations are really good about addressing it like a team, like we're all on the same team. And I, I find that if you prepare yourself mentally to meet the other person where they are at, to see the whole truth, and to not make them wrong or to not make them your adversary, just that subtle shift can change the quality of that exchange.
Nice. I love it. We should probably get to some of the questions.
Yeah, I mean,
too.
I think we've kind of addressed a lot of this stuff.
We have.
One of the big things that's very specific to this year that came up a lot, and we were actually just talking about before we brought you on, was obviously there's a lot of political stuff going on right now, and there's a lot of stuff going on with the pandemic, and we have people who have very polarized positions on that are working together. And a lot of the questions that we were getting were like, how do I deal with employees who have very different opinions about, let's say, masks? And they're not going to change their stance on it, but we have to wear masks in our comm center. We do, not everyone does, whatever. So when you, for example, have a center where you're requiring masks, but you have employees who don't believe that masks are helping, how do you kind of address that negativity? Is there a way to, I don't know, sort of circumvent that and just get them to deal with it? I don't know.
Well, ultimately we're talking about differing opinions on policy and procedure in that specific example. And like, when, if the policy is that when a caller calls me a lazy asshole, I have to continue to be polite and courteous in response. My personal viewpoint is that that person has it coming, and I may disagree with the policy. That doesn't mean I get to give them what's on my mind when they call me a lazy asshole. Okay. It's the same thing. So like, we don't have the luxury of disagreeing with such black and white policies and procedures in this role. We work in a paramilitary organization. And so if you're talking about politics and these sensitive topics within the comm center, we in a lot of ways are choosing, I don't know, we're choosing to bear that cross. I had a real tough time with non-emergency calls at my entire career. Like I called in sick more than 3 times, knowing that tomorrow I was assigned the non-emergency complaint line. Think about that. That's a third of the entire workload. So at LAPD, if you're assigned the phones for the day, you're assigned either 911 for the entire day, or you're assigned the non-emergency complaint line for the entire day, or you're assigned the radio. And so you're working a radio frequency as the dispatcher for that patrol division. So there's only 3 possible scenarios for my spending my 10-year career. If I say I have a abject problem with 1/3 of the entire work.
Yeah, you just like ate 1/3 of your job.
That is my problem personally. That is my issue. So I encourage each one of us to consider where we are making our own lives more difficult, because we're holding on so violently to the fact that that person across from us is wrong.
Yeah.
We're very set in our ways. We're type A perfectionists by and large. Most are that way. We're very rigid in our thinking. And so when I hear things like that, like how do I tolerate the person next to me? I guarantee that the mask issue is just one articulation of this intolerance.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
No, that makes sense.
Because you might have a person that is constantly the one that will use the term stirring the pot, and it irritates the shit out of you the entire time.
Right.
But then, of course, now they're going to pick on this issue. And if you're very passionate about pro or against or thinking they're stupid, whatever the case may be, and they're on the other side of that, it just makes it that much worse.
Right. Like it inflames the whole issue. Because you're looking for stuff to be angry about at that point.
Right.
So
interesting.
No, and that makes sense. That's a good answer, because that was one of the questions that we kept getting that we're not really sure how to address that, because it's like, how do you deal with people who have very different views from you? And obviously all of that stuff is on blast right now.
Right.
All of that stuff is at the forefront of everyone's minds. Mm-hmm. So I was just saying, like, I had no idea what any of my partner's political views were until this year. And now I'm very acutely aware of all of it. Like, it's like, I don't necessarily want to be, because it shouldn't matter.
Yeah.
But suddenly it does, because everyone's very upset and frustrated and freaked out about it. So
and of course, it's at work, you can't get away from it.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, and you say, it didn't matter prior, and it does matter now. And this is going to sound like philosophical or even ethereal or woo woo, but I would argue that it didn't matter before, and it doesn't really matter now either. We just think it does.
Right. Exactly. Right. Yeah.
So we're making mountains out of molehills, and we as human beings, we do this all the time. And like, when we talk about the highly politicized nature of the world today, and we talk about the pandemic, what we're really saying is that we had all these issues that were below the surface, and now they've simply bubbled up above the surface, and they're in your face. So all of the challenges that we faced, both as a society and as an industry. So let's take it back to the communication center. These problems were always there.
Right.
What's happening in the world today simply has exacerbated what was always there. And if we can work to be more compassionate, we can work to we need to do more personal work in general. That's the only way we can free ourselves from our outmoded patterns and rigidity, is by saying, I still can show up and make a difference in the lives of each caller. I can still show up and make sure that my guys go home safe at the end of the night. My girls and guys, the police officers, the firefighters. I can do the very best that I know how to on a daily basis. And in the meantime, I can read my book. I can crochet or knit.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I wrote Food Network, right?
I wrote two books and launched a business and went to business school while on downtime at the dispatch center. And I had a choice. I could either do that, or I can involve myself with the dragon that the clicks were next to me. I just decided that my peace and sanctity and eventual personal success was more important to me than participating. And there's always going to be stuff to complain about.
Well, I think that it's interesting. So one of the things you mentioned in there is compassion. And I'm looking at this one question that somebody submitted to us about compassion fatigue. Mm-hmm. And obviously that comes up, but it also brought up a question in the meantime as to how can you get somebody to one, be more compassionate or empathetic, because they've done it for so long, they're just tired of hearing it, or they've turned it off because it's just too much, you know? So you have compassion fatigue. So it kicks in and people are just checked out because they can't care anymore. It's taken over.
Out of
Or, I mean, you could even find an employee. I think we've had that where you get an employee that comes in and they interview well, they test well, they're training well, but they just don't have that empathy or that compassion or the ability to put it into perspective to go, okay, this is why I need to do this way. And I think that's an issue that comes up a lot of times with, no offense, millennials, but I think that's what a lot of times happens with some millennials too, you know, and I'm not criticizing millennials. I'm just saying that that's a complaint about millennials from boomers, whatever you want to say, not having that empathy because they didn't grow up the same way we did. They're a little bit disconnected. Not all of them, of course. I don't mean to generalize. I'm just
pointing
sense
out an actual
community though is a little bit lost on that.
Yeah,
I think.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So how do you invoke that in somebody or light that fire? And then how do you deal with somebody that's had it and has lost it because it's just too much?
Well, again, we have to decide that, first of all, it's important. Do you believe that dealing with the work that we do in a kind and empathetic way matters for the organizational goals?
Right.
And I think that we can all agree that if customer service is like excellent, excellent customer service is something that we believe in, and if you're not engaging the quote unquote customer, who is the public, in an empathetic way, then there is a dimension of your customer service that's faulty. So that's objective reality, right? And so that's the first step. Second step is to then address it. You don't have to be sunshine and roses every single day, but if your compassion fatigue and burnout and crustiness is coming out in your interactions with the public, it is making us look bad. And if you don't care if how we look, the reputation of the organization to the public, then it is grounds for paper. Like the reason why discipline exists is when people don't get it, eventually they'll get it. Like it took me 7 years of bubbling up. Like if you want to talk about progressive discipline, I speak all levels of progressive discipline. Like I was knocking, I literally was sitting across the table from a sergeant who used to work in internal affairs before he was assigned communications division. And Sergeant Hoyt said to me, "Adam, you're getting dangerously close to the point in your career where your union can no longer protect you." Like, so like there was in no uncertain terms, he's saying, clean up your act or you're out of here.
Right.
And
I
by that time, 7 years in, I was making good money as a dispatcher. I still hadn't completed my business degree. And so I had very little prospects. I have very few other places to go except within. So I hate to sound like I'm beating a dead horse or being a broken record here, but the challenges, and to bring it back to like the entire entire center and the entire industry, the challenges that we face, the perennial problems that plague the industry, staffing, morale, mandatory overtime, all these things that we talk about year in and year out, they are the result of a lack of organizational self-awareness. And in every single case that I've documented of centers that have completely turned themselves around, it started with someone going, "Huh, we can't work like this anymore."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they did it for themselves, but then they began to talk about it so that others caught the vision. I don't know any. I've been in a room of 300 people in one of my breakout sessions at NINA or APCO, the national conference, and I ask people, raise your hand if you believe that positivity matters in the communication center, and 99% of people raise their hand. So how, like, 300 people, 99% acceptance. Yes, positivity matters. Yet most of those people in that room go back to the center, and suddenly positivity doesn't mean so much anymore.
Right, like they're not holding themselves responsible for that. They're right. Saying like, oh, it's someone else's job to be positive. It's not my job.
Right.
There's a disconnect between what we know is good for us and what we actually do with that awareness.
Well, I also think that, I've only been a dispatcher. I say only. I've been a dispatcher for this month will be my 11th year. And I never dispatched anywhere else. So I've been at one agency my entire career. So I can only put it into perspective of what I know from the people that I've worked with that have come and gone, that are still there. And some folks think positivity is, you know, doing a group cheer or something at the beginning of the shift, or being overly, oh yay everybody, you know, and that's not really it that doesn't hurt. It might annoy the shit out of somebody, but
the top cheesiness is not really what we're talking
unless
about.
That's right. Who the person is, right? Otherwise, so it's not real. If the person is overly positive and happy and genuine, let them be that way. And maybe just take a little something from them, or realize that isn't who anybody's asking you to be. I'm not asking anybody to change who they are as a person if their beliefs are really their beliefs, you know?
No, but when your attitude is affecting other people, that's a problem.
Correct. But there's a difference, I feel like, in beliefs and values versus a shitty attitude.
Right.
You know? I just want your attitude to get better. Sorry, I don't mean to keep cutting
you off. But the original question was about compassion fatigue, and and really what I think the core challenge that we're discussing is, how can we continually use empathy as a tool? And I've seen job descriptions for 911 dispatchers, 911 telecommunicators, and I don't know any center that doesn't include working with the public, using empathy as an aspect of the job description. And so if someone is unable or unwilling ultimately to re-engage their empathy, then that's grounds for a conversation. And again, tremendous amount of empathy for those who keep doing it, 12-hour shift, 16-hour shift, day in and day out. It's not easy. And from all the research that we know, all the studies that we have seen in our industry, that cumulative stress causes PTSD, duty-related trauma and PTSD and vicarious trauma. It affects us in our communication center just as it affects the folks out in the field responders. So that is the nature of the beast. And if you then go home and it's just another venue for work, meaning you say yes to everyone who asks you to do things for them. You have this honey-do list that is long as next year, and you're not prioritizing your self-care. Here's where we get into, like, how do you keep all this straight? Like, here's where we get into why things that then happen around us exacerbate the issues, is because we as a group, and I'm going to be very, very general and paint with a broad brushstroke here, but as a group of people, we are heroic caregivers, and we tend to put everybody else's needs ahead of our own, both on and off the job. And so then you say, okay, here's a little spicy pandemic for you. Here's some highly politicized civilization and society to digest. Our bandwidth was already full and has been for 10 years. How do we digest what's actually going on now? Well, we don't. And so we lash out in both subtle and not so subtle ways. And looking at the content of the questions that you sent me beforehand, that's where we find ourselves, like going, oh my gosh, we're being forced to question how we got where we are today. And if we then, after that assessment, say, okay, what got me here is not going to get me there to where I want to be, which is you get to define what happiness or success looks like to you. But if the way that got me to where I am today is not going to bring me happiness or success or whatever, however I define that, then I need to do something different.
That's interesting. I'm contemplating. That's why it's quiet, because my brain is working. Right. You know, over time, like there's so many things that well, but in a fantastic way, like I'm going,
amazing,
Jesus, why didn't I think of this before, you know?
Right.
So I don't want to digress too much from that.
People too are kind of losing their outlets for self-care.
Yeah.
And not really thinking about that being an aspect, well, but it is, because you're being limited on what you are supposed to be doing or allowed to do right now. Like, you can't go hang out with friends, really. I mean, you can, but shouldn't be or whatever. I don't know what your
it's everything. Oh, my gym is closed. So now instead of trying to figure out a way to burn off some energy, you just get pissed off about it. I can't go to a restaurant or hang out with my friends, but if I do, I have to worry about who's judging me while I'm doing it. It's all of it. Am I going to get in trouble for it? Am I going to have to quarantine over something that I feel is stupid because I hung out with a bunch of people last weekend, even though I know all of those people and I hang out with them regularly and I pretty much know where they've been. Is somebody else going to go tell on me and say, oh, well, that's what they did and I don't feel it's cool they're here or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
All that stupid little stuff that, and you know, this is a whole other podcast, but I blame a lot of social media and disconnecting from people for that stuff.
Yes, everyone, no one looked it off their phone right now. Like everyone is so absorbed in their Facebook and Twitter and Instagram.
And it's nothing like, but it's a lot of negativity.
Right. It's causing all of us to walk on eggshells with each other too. And that's another big stressor in and of itself.
Correct.
So along that, so I think this was another big one, and this is definitely a question that I would like an answer to. I know that there is no quick fix to any of this, right? Like we can't just be like, everyone makes the joke like, oh, throw a pizza party, everyone will be fine. Like that's not gonna work.
Right.
But do you have any advice on sort of a quicker morale booster that could be implemented really really quickly that might help immediately, that might have some immediate results on morale?
Do you sell magic pills?
Yeah. Do you Adam? Have a wand that you could wave?
No. Right.
Well, there's no silver bullet. There's no quick fix. But I think having a real conversation with your watch is a starting point.
It's time and consistency, I think, with a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but I'm saying many of us, like, we know what the problem is, but no one's really doing anything about it. That's why the way we've always done it continues to persist, is because no one really like raises their hand and say, hey, you know, I had this idea that it might be easier to work with each other if we actually got to know each other. And then people go, oh yeah, you know, you're right. So I starting wherever you are, first of all, is the best step forward. And then just doing anything, whatever that looks like to you, whether it's getting to know the coworker that you don't know very well, whether it's having when I'm doing a leadership class with 911 supervisors, one of the primary takeaways that most leave those classes with is I need to have more one-on-one meetings with my people. I need to meet as a team. I think we take it for granted that just because we're locked in a room together, that we're a team, or like we're a healthy, high functioning team. It doesn't happen that way. Teams do not form by accident. It takes diligent, intentional work to work as a team, to come together as a team. And so how do you, first of all, defining what a high functioning team looks like, what does the best team that you've ever been a part of do differently than where you currently find yourself? And you might say, oh my gosh, that's above my pay grade. Why? I know frontline telecommunicators who are not imbued with a positional power and authority by their role or their title, meaning they're not a supervisor, they're not a manager, yet they are still seen as leaders at their centers. If you're seen as a leader and you see that there's an opportunity to change things for the better, then I encourage you to raise your hand and talk to somebody about it. It doesn't have to be like Moses parting the Red Sea, like this big pronounced thing. It can be just start having conversations.
I feel like communication gets forgotten about a lot. Like we're
specializing
communication, but don't talk to each other at all.
Yeah. Well, and that's everything. Like it's not even just on a personal level. When you stop to think about what doesn't get communicated on a daily basis that's important is pertaining to your job, even in a communication center.
Right.
You're like, okay, this is what we do. We have a zillion ways to do it and nobody uses any of them. Like,
right.
Right.
How come we didn't know about this, but the other shift did, or whatever the case may be. That's it's always baffles me. The one thing that I see on here, a few times, obviously, and I think it could probably be addressed in one fell swoop, is management, administration, getting support from them. One person had asked the question about how do you get them to see that there's a problem or take ownership of it? And somebody else said, why do they put it on us to fix? You know,
feel like their problems fall on deaf ears. Like maybe they've tried to address it with management and it's just getting ignored.
One of the things that I was going to say before you answer that, and my thought was when I read the question is, okay, so they're not going to support you in getting better. Why are you waiting for them to do it?
Right.
It's not just, it is on them to try and fix certain issues and you have to report them to them. But if morale sucks, why are you sitting around waiting for management to wave the magic wand? You can say, well, why aren't they doing anything? Okay, well, why the hell aren't you doing anything?
Right.
You know, if you want it to be better, work to help make it better. That's all you can do. And if it doesn't work out, then you have some choices to make, I guess, ultimately in the long run. But how do you address that with administration and management and getting their buy-in to see that there's an issue and help you with this stuff?
I don't know any person who occupies a management role. And I'm using that term just to indicate the upper levels of the organizational hierarchy. I don't know anyone who occupies one of these positions who, when offered a well thought out solution to a problem that everyone knows is a problem, who wouldn't say, oh yeah, sure, go ahead. Like, I think what we like to your point, we sit around waiting for someone to do something. And most managers are just so busy. Yeah, there's bad managers. There's bad supervisors, bad managers in every organization. Oftentimes, they're not bad because of the reasons we think they're bad. They're just busy. And I find that most who ascend the organizational hierarchy in 911 over the lifetime of a career, they forget what the problems are of the frontline telecommunicator. Only those who work on the frontline and closely in contact with the frontline know what those problems are. So we need to develop workable solutions. That's when I started the stress reduction program at the dispatch center, after going through a stress reduction program myself that changed my life, I didn't wait for a supervisor to develop that program. I developed the program and I wrote it all out. And I submitted the initial proposal to a lieutenant who had seen my transformation. He was like, hey, this looks great. Run it by the captain. And so I went to the captain, and the captain said, hey, I will support this. Anything that makes life easier around here, I'm 100% on board. I did that. I had to do the work of mustering up my courage, pulling up my big boy pants. And then I just wrote down my thoughts. And that program ran for 18 months. Over 100 of my coworkers came through the program. And guess what? I was still a frontline telecommunicator. I wasn't even an instructor. I had no positional power, authority, or clout whatsoever. But I dared to dream that the tools that changed my life would also help the people around me.
And I think people forget about the whole, because we've actually had this come up at my center recently, where people are upset with how something's being done. Mm. I don't like that we do it this way. And my answer is always, okay, what do you think we should do instead? And they're like, well, I don't know, but I just don't like it.
Right.
Okay. And I'm always like, okay, I appreciate that. But until you offer me a different solution,
right,
I'm not really sure what you want me to do.
Right. Especially if you have I don't know what just happened there. Especially if you have a majority of people that don't have a problem with it.
Right. You know? One person's coming. And I guess what I was saying was just, it's how you approach your supervisor. Mm-hmm. You can't just come up and be like,
I don't like this. I think it's stupid.
Yeah, right.
Because and then that's not have helpful. A good reason it's, for not it. Constructive. It's just, oh, you know, Joe's bitching about how this is done. And that's great, but it shouldn't be on management to come up with a solution for everything.
And I'm sorry to say, is Joe the guy or gal, you know, it could be just J-O, the guy or gal that bitches about everything.
Right.
You know, so today it's this process, tomorrow it's, you know, the sun is shining, whatever. They're just
but yeah, there's
known to be that
there's
person.
There's definitely a difference between, I don't like how we do this, or I don't like that this is happening, and hey, you know what, I have this idea for doing it like this. What do you think? I wrote up this policy or whatever. Right. I've done that before. I've come to my manager with policies that we didn't have, and she's like, oh, cool. This is great. Thanks.
Right.
Like,
exactly. You're surprised how perceptive they are when you have a solutions-based approach to it.
Yeah, they're like, oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Thank you for doing this. It's not like, you know, sometimes people feel like they're sneaking around behind someone's back by doing that, but I think it's just how you approach it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I agree. What were some of our other takeaways from our questions?
We didn't go through each question point by point, but I think he did address a lot of it.
Yeah.
I think another big one was everyone, this was a good one. I really like this question. So everyone right now, their attitude is, well, it's 2020. Like, forget it. Everything's just gone to shit because it's 2020.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And now we're nearing the end of 2020, and I don't know why everyone thinks that 2021 is going to be vastly different.
It's going to be a light switch.
It's
going
to be like an atomic bomb that goes off.
The game doesn't
like,
just
shit, it's no different
again.
Now.
But I mean, a lot of people are in this negative headspace of it's 2020 and everyone's just expecting awful things to happen at this point.
Yeah.
So how do we kind of keep ourselves and each other out of that negative it's 2020 headspace?
And not just that, but to piggyback on it, one of the other questions I'm going to put them together is, and it goes along with it, is what are some things as people and telecommunicators we can do to de-stress, you know,
to avoid burning out,
you know, like we started doing the yoga program for folks to do. I know that's some of those things. You know, what are some good, I don't know, personal things that we can do to help us with this kind of thing,
the stress
of the job and everything else.
Negative thought process.
Yeah.
Again, we have to be willing to look at what's actually going on in our own lives. I think that in general, we can say that 2020 has been a tough year, and certainly there's specific families who have been rocked by death and COVID related stuff. And but by and large, I find that there's still things to be grateful for. So gratitude is a practice that will change your life, and it also fights the temptation to complain about everything. Yeah, things we're going to continue to encounter challenges, but is there a silver lining? And there's always a silver lining. There's always something to be grateful for. There's we work in a mission critical industry. These jobs are not going away. We always will have a job. There is a huge cross section, millions and millions of people who do not have jobs. So that's something to be grateful for. Yes. Whether or not you like your job and who you work for and who you're locked in a room with for 12, 16 hours, that's debatable. Even that is workable. Nothing is as solid or rigid as we think it is. It's all porous. It's all shades of gray. And can we just kind of sit in that space? I think that's one of the things that changed my life was being still. Like I took a mindfulness class, and cultivating stillness allowed me to see what I was chasing. And the fact that I was doing so, rushing to the next day with my shoulders all tense and my jaw clenched, and by just relaxing, I was like, huh, actually, I have a lot more wiggle than I initially cared to believe. Doing things that bring you joy. There's always things that you can use to tap joy, but in a healthy way. You know, I love that we're having this conversation driven by humanizing the headset. Like, there's so much value in that statement. Like, how else do we expect to thrive in this job if we are not human? And the job causes us to grow disconnected from the very things that make us human, including emotions, empathy, seeing our counterparts' point of view, being able to invent solutions and see things more than one way. Like, the job causes us to be very, very rigid because that's part of it. But in order to remain human in the job, we need to tap those aspects that make us human, those aspects of our own personal life that make us human. How do you connect with your inner child? What do you love to do? When's the last time that you really smiled and laughed and played and had a good time? And you say, well, it's 2020. We can't, it's 2020 is a metaphor for how you've been white knuckling it to tomorrow for the last 10 years.
That's wow. A really powerful statement, yeah. Right there.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, we're all like furiously.
2020 is a scapegoat.
Furiously basically. Taking notes. Yeah.
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 You're really smart, Adam.
I know. It's amazing that we had you on. It's like it was Thank on you. Purpose or something. I think that's a big thing. So one of the things, playing is a great thing that I found, and it's people don't do it enough because they think it's childish instead of childlike, you know. There's a huge difference in the two. You know, if you're going out egging a school bus, okay, that's childish. But if you're playing a board game, even if it was a board game with a group of friends that you played when you were a kid, that's childlike. You're just remembering the fun stuff that you did. And it's very inspiring and fun. I mean, it just really is. And if you want to make it an adult childlike game, you do some shots when you don't pass go or something.
Sure.
But it's all, you know, it's just all what you make of it. You know, you can do all of that stuff. And then the one thing I was going to say is I know a Vietnam veteran, he's a Medal of Honor winner. And one of the things, he wrote a book and he talked about having PTSD for a very, very long time. And he was not a good person. And one of the things he found was service. He found that he missed that and he started to do service work, like volunteering and helping people. And it really changed his outlook and attitude and helped him cope with the stuff that he was dealing with. He says it all the time. It saved him and saved his marriage and all kinds of stuff, because he said he's not a good person. He wasn't a good person to his wife, to his kids, none of that stuff. And because he started volunteering and doing things that he found made him happy, it changed his whole outlook. And you know, to know this guy, he's an amazing person. But to hear him say it, it's really interesting. You know, we've done the Feed My Starving Children thing as a group. You know, you can't do it right now, but it's gratifying. And that's one of those things that goes back to talking about empathy that we were talking about earlier. If you can do it for somebody else and see the effect that it has, that might be able to light that fire in you or inspire it inside of you. So,
yeah.
No. I think service for others is equally selfish and selfless.
It is, because it makes you feel good.
Sure. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though, you're doing something right. For it's someone like
the,
else.
The Friends episode, right? Where Phoebe keeps trying to do something.
Oh, do something, and she's selfless.
Selfless. And he's like, yeah, but you still feel good. And she'd be like, damn it. And she'd try to find something
she
else.
She ended up like volunteering for like 10 different things.
Right.
And pointed out every time, like, well, but you felt good about it.
So funny. So funny.
Hmm. All right. Well, I think that really answers most of our questions.
I think so. It's so important. And I'm happy, because there's been some stuff that I can say that at our 911 center, specifically on our shift, we've been trying to make some changes and re-inspire, get people to come together. And this has opened up a lot for me. I was actually excited about this, still am. You haven't disappointed at all, Adam. And it's awesome. So it's given me some ideas, because I had questions as to how I'm going to do certain things. And I've gotten a lot of those answers today. So I appreciate you very much for that. Thank you.
And we do appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this, because I think this has just been, like we said, it's a theme of 2020.
Yeah.
Can I just say how I cannot picture Adam of the first 7 years of being a dispatcher, like seeing, hearing you now.
Angry Adam. That's what my coworkers called me, Angry Adam. Yeah.
I cannot imagine it.
Right. Like, you're such a smiley, sweet person. I can't imagine you ever being rude to anyone.
It's confidence inspiring.
Yeah, definitely. It really is.
For sure.
Well, it shows you that if you can do it, everybody else should be able to figure out a way to do it too. Absolutely. And not to should on people. There's no shame there, but
we all can.
Can do it.
It's can important. Be done. I think it's important, not just for your coworkers, but for yourself.
For yourself. Absolutely.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you, Adam. We appreciate it so much.
Yes. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation. And I look forward to continuing the conversation either online, or we can do another one of these whenever. It's been a joy.
Yeah, awesome. Absolutely. And real quick, plug, what were your books again?
Yes.
Plug those.
First book is Dispatcher Stress, 50 Lessons on Beating the Burnout. And the most recent was People Driven Leadership, How the Best 911 Centers Inspire Positive Change. They're both available on Amazon.
Awesome. And then if people want to reach out to you or hear more about you, I'm assuming you're on Facebook, social media.
I'm on Facebook, social media, the website. And I'm definitely out there and very accessible. And I would encourage anyone to reach out. If you have any questions whatsoever, don't hesitate.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Thanks. Bye.